You're listening to KTNA, Talkeetna. And now for Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the Northern Susitna Valley. Created by your friends and neighbors at Pothole Productions and Talkeetna Community Radio, from comic relief to serious beliefs, each week brings you a fresh nugget. I'm Holly Stinson, and today we'll hear the third and last part of John Baker's adventures in Alaska. In the first two nuggets, we heard about Trapper John's three trips up the highway from Michigan in the 1950s, finding work in Alaska, and going trapping in the Kahilna River area. Join Trapper John now as he tells us what he trapped and what he did with the pelts. So what else did you trap out there? Beaver were along the river?
Along the
lakes?
Right. Rivers,
yeah.
Ponds, streams. The Kahilna River itself didn't have them in the wintertime or at any time, mainly because, see, it fluctuates so bad. So, and it's silty. And beaver coming out of silty water aren't too nice either, because that silt goes all through their fur. And that isn't your best beaver.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, Beaver and Martin was my principal things I trapped. And then after that, then you got whatever you could. It would be mink, and some years you could get muskrat, but the muskrat weren't always there. They'd winter kill out, and so there never was many. And they'd only be there occasionally. But apparently if they had a good, easy winter and didn't freeze out or something, they would replenish themselves quickly. But there'd be years to a time when I wouldn't get any. Mm-hmm. Animal life out there really goes up and down a lot.
Oh, okay.
Weather, and it has nothing to do with man. That was the interesting thing that I found, because man was... There wasn't out there.
Yeah.
There wasn't any within 40 miles of me, for the most part.
Wow.
So a man was not a factor in any way. And so there would be years there would be no muskrat. There would be years when there'd be no spruce ants. And for years there was ptarmigan there, and there would be years, finally there was no ptarmigan. There were very little.
Mm.
This moves up and down. I remember one spring, as an example, which is surprising, and I was into photography then, and I was photographing this one. There was a family of spruce ants still together, and I was towards the end of the season, and I'd picked up everything, and so I was just killing time. I was waiting for the pilot to come in to get me. I don't know how many days he was late that time. But anyway, every day for something to do, I'd go see if I could jump up this covey of spruce ants. And so I had fun with them, seeing where they'd spend the night. Sometimes it was interesting, they would spend the night. It was just they'd be flying along, and all of a sudden you'd see a bunch of holes in the snow. They would fly along and just hit the snow. They'd evidently fold their wings and go in. And there'd be absolutely no sign. There was no walking on top of the snow, no nothing, any place. But you'd see those holes in the snow.
So they would just go in, and then they would take back off?
Yep. They'd stay there overnight.
Oh,
they'd
okay.
stay there overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have to search all over the next day on snowshoes, but I wasn't doing nothing. But if I got close to them, then they'd bust out. Uh-huh. The way they would go. Good.
Wow.
And it was just interesting and to see that.
Mm-hmm.
What I was getting at is when I left that spring, I said, man, I'm going to have some spruce ends around here. And I'd never shoot a spruce end within... half a mile of the cabin, because I always wanted them around in case I ever needed them. And so that was in the spring of the year, And there was that whole family was still intact. There must have been at least six or seven of them. And I said, by golly, really going to have a lot of spruce ends this next fall. I think it was two or three years before I seen another spruce end. Wow. And the first one I seen after two or three years was 10 miles away. Something happened. Mm-hmm. Either something thinned them out, or something happened to the hatch. Their eggs didn't hatch for some reason. Something happened. Mm-hmm. But the only reason I'm pointing this out is man was not a factor. Mm-hmm. Every year was always a little different. It was always interesting. You could follow how the moose were doing and how many died in a given winter. Some winters were really bad on them. Those were some deep snow winters, some of them, and some years they were dying by Christmas.
Because of the deep snow and not able to get around and eat. Did you always get one to eat out there?
My partner always did, but they weren't easy. In other words, I was always on foot. And they can hear you coming. They can hear you coming.
They heard Queenie, probably.
yeah. It's not as easy as you think. When we'd go out, we'd take 10 pounds of meat or something with us. We'd always take at least a nice slab of bacon. We'd take some hamburger or something. But this was only going to last us a week or something, except the bacon. The bacon, we'd have one or two pieces a day, and that was rationed out a long way. But as far as the meat goes, we were depending on what we could get out there. And I remember one year we couldn't get a moose. Not only that, we couldn't get a beaver. And we were dependent on that. It was finally on Thanksgiving we got our first beaver, and so that was our Thanksgiving, was that beaver.
You eat the meat?
Oh, yeah, beaver's good.
And then the fur, would you sell the fur in Anchorage?
Some would go to Anchorage. If you were in a hurry to be paid, you could take it to David Green, and he would buy them right on the spot, cash money. Mm-hmm. You never got top dollar, but you had it right now. Mm-hmm. Some went to Seattle fur auction. And we had another, Moss and Steppen in New York is where we sent a lot of stuff.
So you would mail them off?
Yeah, it would be mailed off. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at one point, Sears and Roebuck bought fur.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Sears was fair. Sears... You'd send your fur to Sears. They would send you back what their price was. They would notify you what the price was for those fur. And then you had your choice of taking it or leaving it. And also, you could take that out in trade. That was all good in their catalog. And so, quite often, if I sent to Sears, there was no money to trade it at all. I sent them the fur. I picked out the things I wanted out of their catalog. They had a neat little, in fact, I wished I still had one today. They had a neat little catalog or pamphlet, more of a pamphlet, you might say, that they would send out in the fall of the year. And there was a young trapper in there called Johnny Muskrat. And this was all, it was slanted towards young folks, young trappers getting started. But it was interesting. They would tell about, Johnny Muskrat would tell about somebody from North Dakota. He had just sent in this and that. And I would like to have one of those little pamphlets yet.
So it was mostly beaver that you sold, and then sometimes...
Beaver, Martin, and Martin, and Wolverine, and Fox, and, well, that was mostly it. Mm-hmm.
Next, John Baker gets an airplane, migrates to Talkeetna, and tells of his summer work.
And your partner, Jean, you ended up pretty much being on your own,
yes.
Didn't you?
Yeah, I think in about 1970, he left and went to the States.
So you were out there. It was pretty much you and Queenie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That did all the... You'd go out in the fall.
Yeah.
And you might come in at Christmas and then go back out and you'd be out till
break. By this time, I had my own airplane. So I could come or go as pretty much as I wished. Certainly, really from about 1967 on... Mm-hmm. I had my own plane up until I just sold that plane just a year ago.
But, and so when you, to get out there and to leave, you used the gravel bars in the Cahiltna River also?
If it was before snow. If it was once the snow and the ice came, then I could use many options. Then I could get closer if I had to use the gravel bars or whatever, I might have to walk. The closest I might be able to get is a mile or a mile and a half to the cabin. And then I had a couple of moving streams across. You needed hip boots and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the plane would be more exposed, leaving it that far away. So the quicker I could get it closer to me, the better off I was. Mm-hmm. And then I had another cabin to the south down at Summit Creek. And there I could, by that time the river was totally froze, and I had a nice little lagoon that I could pull into to protect it from the wind. It was a nice spot, and I could have that pretty close to the cabin then. It depended where I was.
Mm-hmm. You had three different cabins out there?
I had three different cabins, but I only used two. Two was, when I was snowshoeing on foot, I had three. But that one was never that productive. I would have had to, there was no place I could land near it. It basically, I could do all I wanted to do with two.
Mm-hmm.
And one cabin was basically in the beaver area. And I would try to have my beaver by, say, Christmas. And then I would move to my other cabin to the south of me, which was basically Martin. And then you get a sprinkling of everything at each one, you know. You mm-hmm. might get Fox, you might get Wolverine, or you might get...
it's always a surprise what you're going to get.
Yeah. And then later on, Graham Maurer was up at Shalatna, and he wanted me to go up there and babysit that for him. So the last couple of years I was out there, I was out there altogether about 18 years. The last couple of years that I was out there, I spent a fair amount of time up at Shalatna. And I watched, basically I was just a caretaker there for him at that lodge.
And then you sort of migrated towards Talkeetna?
Yes. There was other things that I could spend my time better at. And so I started, gravitating more towards Talkeetna. I could, I had a place in Talkeetna by this time and had been. But it was got so that I would build another building a year at Talkeetna. I had several buildings there. I started getting into my interest started getting into a few other things, tractors and old cars, and I got to rebuilding both old cars and tractors. And then I think when was it? I think it was in about 81 or something like that, that I got the homestead, that 196 acres up by Larson Lake. And so from that point on, that certainly occupied all any spare time that I had to build that up.
And in the summers, then you would go out and
I was still working in the summer times. I was a welder, like I mentioned. Mm-hmm. We built docks and bridges and offshore platforms. I helped build, I worked on every platform in the inlet except one. And then once that was built out, they started the North Slope. And so from there, for the most part, I went straight to the North Slope. And I was in the first group of welders that went up there to get that place ready. Mm-hmm. It kept me busy, and I only wanted to be busy 3 months out of the year or something.
You had other things to do rest of the time.
Right. I had other things to do. So basically that was my type of life.
It sounds like a wonderful life.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad.
Now, when you were out trapping on the Kahiltna, so it was you and Queenie.
Yeah.
And were you ever scared being out there by yourself? Was there ever anything that terrified you? Or
never.
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 And did you ever have visitors besides animals? Or I mean, did anybody ever drop by? Nobody just drops in out there.
Cliffwood. I had a neighbor, Vic Fondy, on Treasure Creek, that would come out once in a while. Once a winter or every other winter. Mm-hmm.
I'm Holly Stinson, and I'm visiting today with John Baker, known as Trapper John. In the last segment of this nugget, he tells the famous story of Queenie, the miracle dog.
It was in January of 1966. Jean and I had gone into Anchorage for Christmas, and while in there, Jean bought a brand new Johnson ski horse, and it was top of the line, wide track. It was as good as they made in 1966, and we were going to take that out to the trap line, and in 1966 you could drive to Talkeetna by then. So we put it in the back of my pickup and drove to Talkeetna in January after Christmas to drive out. We're going to take it overland and to the Kahiltna. Well, and we still had Queenie with us, and so that we made a deal with Cliff to fly. I left a bunch of gas cans at the gas station and told them to fill those up and bring those out and land them on the Kahiltna River at Summit Creek and give us at least a day head start. And so Gene and I left pulling a toboggan that had supplies on it, plus some extra gas, and Queenie to run along behind. Well, she hated that snow machine from the minute she seen it. She knew her life was changing, and she was absolutely right. That snow machine changed everybody's life. We couldn't make very good time, so it wouldn't have been any problem for her to keep up. Because there was a couple trappers along the Petersville Road at that time. There was only really a couple people in the whole area. But Bob Young and Johnny Kimball was trapping along there, and they had an old iron track snow machine. And also, Tony Jurassic was trapping along there. And outside of that, there was nobody. Nobody. And so there was sort of a trail to the Petersville Roadhouse. And when I say sort of a trail, these trails get hard. And this old iron track made a given width. And our machine pulling that toboggan couldn't stay in it. And then we couldn't. If we got out of it, we couldn't get back in it. If we got out of it, we got stuck. We couldn't stay in it. And like Bob Young said, it looked like you shoveled all the way there. So anyway, the dog hated the machine. She wouldn't try to stay up. I tried to hold her on the machine. Now there's three of us on the machine. The machine would just plunge into the snow. We could not go. It was a mess. Finally, she got disgusted with the whole thing, and she wouldn't even come close to us. And finally, we never seen her again. And I figured, well, I didn't think I'd ever see her again. But I figured, because we can't monkey with it. We can't. We're strung out. We can't monkey with it. And I figured she'd head back, and she's going to. There was traps along that road. I figured she's going to get caught in somebody's trap. So we had to keep on going, and we spent the first night in a cabin, little cabin. The next day, we left any sign of any track, which that track wasn't any good to us anyway. And we crossed then and headed up across Black Creek Summit. From that point on, we were breaking trail all the way ourselves. And in some ways, it was better than trying to run that other thing. And so we got up on top of Black Creek Summit, and the wind was really blowing across there. And the wind blows across there so much that there's no snow left up there. It's bare. It's bare. While we were up there getting ready to come down, we're still trying to make up our mind how to get down. Cliff came. And up to this point, he could follow our trail, you know. And it turned out when we were up there, we could see him. He was about a mile to our north. We seen him starting to circle. The wind had to be bad. It was rough. We couldn't imagine what he was circling. We thought he was looking for our tracks. But we had no idea that Queenie had gone back to Talkeetna. And when Cliff started to load up the plane that next day, he seen the dog there. And he knew where. He recognized her. He hated that dog for a lot of reasons. Number one, if you're loaded up with a cub, the last thing you need is a 90-pound dog to toss in on top. And she was in there, and they got into that rough air up there. And I know them cans and everything was rattling around. She was laying on top of these cans, and that whole thing started to fill up with gas fumes. She started coming forward, and he was trying to shove her back. And all you have to do is hit that little handle right there on the right on a cub, and that door opens. Well, when that door opened, she bailed out. I always told Cliff, I think he opened it and shoved her out. If I'd have been him, I might have shoved her out anyway. But anyway, they managed to get across the wind-blown area, and when she jumped, he put it into a bank, and he watched her all the way down. And he thought that there was a frozen beaver pond right there, thought she was going to hit that, and she missed the frozen beaver pond, or her trajectory took her over that. And then there was a dead spruce tree, he thought she was going to hit that, she missed the spruce tree, and she just got across to where the bank started to go down, and that's where the snow started to pile up. He put it in a bank and he followed her all the way down. He seen her hit, and he seen the alder fly up. So it had hit where it had a bunch of alder under that was buried in that snow and everything. But he never seen her again. And so, from our vantage point on the ground, we're watching him circle, but we thought he was looking for us, but it wasn't. And so we didn't know anything about it. So late that night, we managed to get to Summit Creek. We had a moon, I guess, and that helped. And we were very lucky to have made that in one night. But we did make it. And we've seen on the riverbank, our fuel was there. And so that's all we expected to be there. And then it snowed for 3 days. So Queenie laid out there. It was on the fifth day after she bailed out of that plane that it cleared off and for Cliff to go back and look for her. And he looked down, and there she was. She was sitting in the snow. So, but he could land up on top someplace. And so he landed, and he had to walk down. He said he had to cut kind of steps, and he had to shove her up a step. And then he'd shove her up another step, and he finally got her up to the top and got her out of there, and he put her in the cub, and he brought her out to us. And she was hurt pretty bad. It was her hindquarters was the worst, and she couldn't hardly stand or anything. So we got her in the cabin, and she just laid in there, and I made her soup, and I broke bones and got the marrow out, and I made her really good soup. So after a while, she got so she could stand, and she just gradually kept getting better and better. I didn't think she'd ever be strong again, but she became strong.
Wow.
She was 7 years old when that happened, and she lived to the end of her life.
That is amazing.
Well, it was an amazing story.
I'm Holly Stinson, and I'd like to thank John Baker for visiting with me today. If you missed the first two parts of his story, you can find them archived on the web at ktna.org. You've been listening to Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the northern Susitna Valley. Do you have a nugget you'd like to share? If you would like to host a show, be a guest on this program, or get involved in some other way, please call the station at 733-1700. You may also contact us through the website at ktna.org. You're listening to KTNA, Talkeetna.